Okay. 18 minutes into the class. We're on page 208.
5 minutes, I guess it was.
and you can, if you read 208, you'll pretty much get what you missed in the class.
It's a proof to say that the darkness was there until the first creation.
Yes, right.
In the class, the darkness is actually the first creation of the light.
Was say that again? Was the first?
It's darkness, the first creation.
It's
not the light.
Right. The light was already there. Right. It was the darkness that was the yesh me'ayin, you could say. But it's not a thing. Like, is it something that Hashem created, or is it just there is a whole theological discussion about is it just the absence of light, or is darkness a creation unto itself, and that. The jury's out on that one.
Yotzer or Renei Hoshe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
So that's real, right? The darkness was created from nothing. Okay.
Right. I mean, that's the full text of that position, but there's, yeah.
Yeah, the thesis says, Hoshe comes from the word Hoshef, a black,
uh-huh.
So that's, you see darkness, but it is essentially representing a void that is there.
The void of light.
Oh, yeah.
To be void in. Uh-huh.
And you don't say that about light, that it's a void of darkness.
Revolution.
No. What do you say about light?
That
you
it,
say Yosef is 40 light.
Because the darkness is the cube of the colors.
Uh-huh, right.
The black is the cube of the colors.
Uh-huh. Right. Isn't it?
But then it's not a left.
Then what?
It's not a left.
I mean, right, and that is actually the Leshem kind of, describes how the Tzimtzum is not the absence of light, it's the absence of the Chassadim, but it's a concentration of the Gevurot, which is also dark light.
Yes.
It is dark light. So, anyway, there's a lot of difference of opinions about all that. But the idea that Adam and Chava were in Gan Eden, knowing that Hashem had been in this expanse of light, and somehow for reason, mysterious reasons to them, Hashem chose to withdraw or conceal His all presence, His light, and then emanate a single reduced beam of light into that space. So they felt like they were in an expanse of light. If they're to imitate Hashem, then they too should, maybe the messages that they should, the message of their bread of shame and the expectation that they will know Hashem, contemplate who God is and what God does and emulate that. That maybe the message, which they happen to be right according to some opinions, was to also mitzamtzem, to kind of darken Gan Eden. And then their mitzvot would make a difference. They would, so interesting, somebody out there, but anyway.
They're doing farming.
Uh-huh.
He needs them to evocate the Nachash's, enticing offers. Has a lot of trouble
with it. Right, right.
They say, if you do this, you will be like Elohim, Yod Eitov Vara, connected to, integrated with Tovero.
Uh-huh.
That's what he's offering.
Right, right. And then Hashem says at the end that they have become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And there's something that was right about it, and also something that was edifying, not just diminishing about it. Right.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think I kind of gave over it. Right, so Adam and Chava chose to follow that breed. And so they felt that the message that the right thing to do. So one of the Kabbalistic teachings, I'm on page 209 in the middle, one of the Kabbalistic teachings, I alluded to this just now, regarding their decision to eat from the forbidden tree, is that they were burdened by the bread of shame, an indignity caused by always being on the receiving end of divine gifts with no chance to earn or reciprocate in a dignified way. Just one more. Hold on. Okay. Here now, post-eating, their actions would make a difference. They would contribute something. Part of the problem was that they knew that they really understood that eating from the Asadat was going to create a darkening. It was going to change and diminish the radiance of Gan Eden, but then it would make visible the mitzvot and avodat Hashem that they would generate through their own selves and their own lives. But they didn't realize what darkness was and what it would bring, the intensity of darkness that their decision to eat would bring and turn the world upside down and inside out, and they wouldn't even know which way was up anymore. Like, it was a very traumatic consequence of eating that they, because they didn't really and couldn't really anticipate what the full impact of their decision would bring. And so, here now, post-eating, this is their thought, their actions would make a difference. They would contribute something significant by revealing divinity in the dark spaces of creation. There are true... Okay, I think that's good enough for them. So, I just want to hold on one second. Okay, this is good. Okay, so Adam and Chava's decision.
Okay. Adam and Chava's decision to eat is corroborated by the Hebrew language itself, for every word communicates the essential truth of the object or the concept that it represents. So the Hebrew word Bala, yeah?
Right. Gimel Lamed Hey.
Is a nucleus of two contrary terms, Gavroid.
Galui.
And Galut.
Galut. Right.
Means revealing to the exile.
Right. So that's, you know, right, go ahead.
Eve took this to heart and based her decision in part on the message it conveyed that the revelation which comes out of exile and the emergence of light against the backdrop of darkness is somehow the essence of what it means to reveal.
Right. So that's another, emulating Hashem is one, and then this, which is the etymological relationship between Gilui and Galut, that there is a, and other sources that kind of convey the same message or lesson, that light in contrast to darkness has a power, things are revealed through the contrast that cannot be revealed when there is
This charge does not appear in the first chapters of Bereshit at all.
It doesn't? That I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. There is even Yikabuv Mayim B'Tela Eh HaYavasha. It will be revealed, but it stays in the term for seen. It will be exposed at Gilui. I think it appears in three chapters even. I'm looking at it. So where is that coming from?
Aharon Dessler.
Of Gilui and Galut.
Yeah. So, right. So, but there is also, like the Tanya talks about, has a whole thing about that, the power of contrast between darkness and light, that there are certain things, the stars are all out during the day, but we can't see them because the surrounding light is so much stronger than the little bits of light that they send towards us. And it's only as the darker, the more the contrast, the darker the sky becomes, the more visible, the weaker stars are able to be seen. So she, their job, their assignment was to reveal Hashem. And so they felt like the mechanics of things is such that it really, that whatever revelation they could conjure, could generate, it would be enhanced by a darkening of the surroundings. And so that was another, argument for in the decision-making process of yes to eat. Dina,
he genuinely believed, Chava genuinely believed that eating from the tree of Na, or from Etz Hadat, was what Hashem, Suten.
I lost my place.
Suten.
Okay.
Yibora Matzil Chava, a.k.a. Eve.
Yeah.
Chava genuinely believed that eating from the Etz Hadat was what Hashem secretly wanted from her and Adam. The serpents, the Nachash, representing her subconscious, convinced her that this was an emergency measure, a sin for the sake of heaven. And that eating the forbidden...
An Avera Lishma, in other words, is the term. An Avera Lishma is the terminology for that.
Avera Lishma, and that eating the forbidden fruits would be a feat of self-sacrifice as well as the most God-serving act she could do.
Right.
My question is like this. So on the
meaning that the darkening that they would create through eating would also entail a lot of work on their part to kind of reveal Hashem, to have to reveal, even though they were wanting to kind of do something that was meaningful, but nevertheless, this was going to require a lot of work and effort on their part. As we see, that's what we're doing now. We're revealing Hashem in the darkness, and it's a real blood, sweat, and tears labor.
They anticipated that?
They anticipated that it was, according to the Ari and Rav Dessler's presentation of his, they anticipated the darkening. They knew that they were going to create a darkening, but they did not have any idea what darkness really was and how so confusing and upside down the world would turn that they wouldn't even know which way is up and down anymore and wouldn't even know where to find the light anymore. I mean, it's like it was a total, like they were totally just shaken and devastated.
Wow. The point is, they knew about the darkness, and they didn't know what that is mean. So there was like an inner temptation. Thank God. To reveal the galop.
Yeah, well, so Rav Dessler does also talk about that there was a sense, it wasn't purely Lishma, like there was a sense of we want to do something that makes a difference. I mean, it's, who doesn't want to do that? You can't hold it against them. But he does say that there is a trace of ego there that is like kind of a...
Before that.
What?
Before that. Right?
Yes, right. That kind of compromised the purity of their intention.
Yeah. I guess that's what being human is all about. That you don't have the purity like a malach. You have all these other things going on.
But the idea here is that you can, you can safely go into the ayin state, which would be pure lishma, because you're going to go into the ani state in the next second, and the ani state also exists. That, you know, there are these. When I was growing up in those science stores, they had these perpetual motion machines where like these wooden things would just go back and forth like this. And so each time the one that's here would stimulate this to go, and then it would go back. And so it's kind of like that, the Ani and the Ayin and the Ani and the Ayin. And you're doing the Ani and someone else is holding the Ayin pole, and then you do the Ani pole and someone else is holding the Ani pole. And it's just, you know, kind of this back. And so that does create the possibility, like, it's safe then to go into Ayin state, like no self, because if someone is not going to, like, it's also the Shema. The Shema is, you know, Hashem Echad. When we say Hashem Echad with full Kavanah, we basically pull the rug out from under our existence. And so immediately we say in a quiet voice, Baruch Shem Kavod Machusa, like Hashem says, Baruch Shem Kavod Machusa, blessed is the name, or Hashem's name, Kavod, the Shechina, it's a nickname for the Shechina, Machusa Shechina. So Hashem is saying, but wait, like when we say Shema, we forgo our aniness in order to proclaim Hashem's absolute oneness. And Hashem instantly forgoes his oneness in order to create space for us to exist as an other Le'olam Vo'ed. And so we are able to, like in Yom Kippur, we can say it, you know, we're worthy of.
Dang it out.
Yeah. But it's, yeah, so it's that safety of being able to say Hashem Echad. Like it says that it used to be that Bnei Yericho, Anshe Yericho, would say the Shema, and they said it with such kavanah that their souls would, they would leave and not come back. And so, how does it go? That they instituted the, right, they instituted that the last syllable of the Shema Echad and the first syllable of Baruch Shem, that there would be no pause between them, so that instantly when their soul left, it would be pulled immediately down by the Baruch Shem Kavod Mahusa Le'olam Vo'ed.
Rapper. As I say, we're back to him.
Yeah.
In continuation, we will say, the message is like this, where Yashir Matik said, Abi Walay Kapara.
He said what?
Abi Walay Kapara.
Uh-huh.
Because I know that I created the evil.
Uh-huh. Right, right.
So,
right, right. Mm-hmm. Right, the buck stops there. Yeah. Yeah.
Question becomes, was she right or was she wrong? Certainly, as we've seen, Ari concludes that although Hashem commanded them not to eat, he also, through his choice of words, assured that they would violate his command, and instead, yes, choose to eat. In other words, according to the Ari, their disobedience was an Avera Lishma, a sin that Hashem wanted to happen and even secretly forced to happen. And if that is the case, then they did the right thing, even though they still had to pay the full debt for the Avera aspect of their deed.
That's the nature of an Avera Lishma, is that, you know, it's kind of, like you might think, oh, I'm going to do an Avera Lishma, I'm going to do an Avera, and I'll say it in Hashem's name, like, who is that famous heretic who converted to Islam? Shabbatai Tzvi. Right, so his whole thing was, Matira Surim, that Hashem permits the forbidden if you do it with the right intention. And so he was involved in all kinds of questionable, idolatrous, right, so
that we are still paying off today.
Right, that an Avera Lishma is, it really is for Hashem's sake, it is an act that Hashem needs and wants to be done, but, and if you choose to do it, you should know that it's really, it is a self-sacrifice, because you are going to have to pay the full debt of the Avera aspect of the Avera Lishma without any discount. And so it kind of takes a bit, like Rav Tzadok talks about, it's Avera Lishma in its purest sense is really the ultimate expression of love of Hashem. Like you're really willing to take on blows in order to do something that Hashem
that means very,
needs to be
very,
done.
Very few people could really do that.
Right.
Only.
Right.
The Merkaba who contains all of us. The fact is.
Yeah, they contained all of us. So
right.
We all gave consensus.
We were all present. And so, in that universe encompassing heaven, we all agreed with the decision to eat. It's only right then.
Of course, that's not everybody.
I think that the message here, one of the deep messages is, if we were there, we'd do exactly the same thing in a second.
Well, that's a question that Rob Sessler also asks, is like, so are we, you know, this whole phase of history is just getting us back to Gan Eden. So what's the guarantee that when we get back there, we're not going to just repeat the whole thing again? So he does say that because we've been there, done that, and we have deep in our nerve system the pain and suffering that was entailed in Tikkun Olam,
Memory cellular.
The
cellular memory.
Right. Yeah, we do have cellular memory.
And that brings us to the deep of the...
I want to skip to, like...
Okay.
Oh, well, okay, just, yeah. Well, but no, let's go to, Okay, yeah, let's just do it.
And that brings us to the deeper mystery of Avera Lishma and how it fits into our mission of cultivating rectified decision making. We are told that Adam and Hava before the sin were not the same, which means that at least theoretically they were free of the falsities that the ego employs to defend itself from shame. That means, again theoretically, that their world psychosis was perfectly reliable. Certainly it took nothing less in that, to know, and to trust the know, that although Hashem explicitly commanded them not to eat, in fact his true preference and secret will was actually for them yet to eat.
Yeah.
To listen in, to sort through all the tons and shouts and conflicting factors when the stakes could not be higher, and to find the self-confidence to trust one's Ruach HaKodesh over an explicit command, and to be right, that is the pinnacle of pure Ami.
Right. So that's Chava as the archetype. That's her.
Mm-hmm.
It's, okay, wait a minute. So to 214. Let's start with the bold.
Yeah, and the bold?
Yeah.
But thank you.
If, 214.
If Ruach HaKodesh correctly sense that Hashem started with love, not his trusty.
Truest love.
It's truest.
Yeah.
And that is synonym for Ruach HaKodesh. So, all the way through, for Hashem in a private, secretly, if intimacy comes from seeing and being seen, then if forged, and if
forged.
Forged,
yeah.
Forged.
It means like,
then if forged, an intimacy with the most hidden and mysterious depth of the
deep. Right, that's a very powerful.
I got it. Love for our deep soul.
Huh?
Deep soul.
Yes,
Wait, so I just want to, because this is, I want to draw attention to this, because this is really important, is that there's so much happening with Adam and Chava's decision, but like, as I always give over, you know, according to the Kabbalistic usage of our understanding of zivug, is that it's seen, it happens on the level of da'at, of seeing and being seen, knowing and being known with loving eyes. And so really what Chava was doing there was that she really saw to the core of Hashem, like saw behind Hashem's words and commands, saw an even more essential level of divinity that she, and that she responded to, that she fulfilled the will of that level of divinity by, knowing that secretly in them Hashem, more than he wanted them to obey his words, Hashem wanted them to,
In a very, very, very low parallel, the wife or the mother who sends her spouse out to work, and he says, you don't have to make anything for supper. And she has cooked a vegetable soup or whatever it is. He comes home and she knows that he was in the coming, even though he said he doesn't want it. His deepest ratzon, his will was to have the pleasure of what she did make for him.
Yeah, so that's a good one.
And she knows exactly what he wants. That's the other piece.
She's
not making room for Christ.
Right, and that's zivug, really. Like that whole thought process that Adam and Chava went through is a real union, like a real zivug of core to core.
That is Ruach HaKodesh, is a chidush, as
we say. Rashi. That's Rashi. When it says Chachma Bina, but Chokma Tivuna of the Das, and he says Das is Ruach HaKodesh.
So actually the book is a connection of will to will.
Will to will, yeah. I mean, even
the deepest level.
Yeah.
For the good, the Chalila can be
But in the very next instant, the consequences of the Avera aspect of the Avera Lishma clicked in. Adam and Chava, along with reality, fell, tumbled, shrunk in stature, narrowed in consciousness. When the dust settled, I'm going to skip to now the 215, first line. This was not what they expected. Their newly consolidated egos were stricken with shock and shame. Yet they had no experience processing such tumultuous emotions. Instantly, their newly minted egos scrambled to repel blame. Adam blamed Chava, Chava blamed the Nachash, and the Nachash blamed them back.
How do you blame get in there?
Right, that's just the primal, like, kind of
avoidance. The wise kind of shame.
Yeah. Like the fastest way to get rid of shame is to dump it on someone else. And so that's blame. That's why anytime anything crisis happens in the city, everyone's immediately blaming everyone else. It's the contractor, it's the people, it's the owner, it's the, you know, it's like everyone. And the whole legal system.
To find the person responsible. It can't be that it's no one's fault. It has to be someone's fault.
Right.
And it can't be my fault.
Right, exactly.
This was the answer to a yes-no question. And it just, did you eat from the tree that I told you not to eat from? And there was no yes-no. Right? There was, he told me, and she told me, and God did.
Right.
It's very prominent. You see it in 2-year-olds or their chocolate all over their face. Did you eat some chocolate? Did you take the chocolate? No.
Yeah.
They made the answer yes, no.
Or they could say, no, he made me, gave it to me. Like, there's always, you know, they ask for times.
Mm-hmm. I just found it.
Yeah.
Okay, so page 220, the, I guess starting from the top, Eva says,
Thank you.
220, top of the page.
Okay. Eve assessed the situation and chose to differentiate for heaven's sake to enable God's purpose for creation to succeed.
Like that's the there's merging and differentiating. The ani is the differentiating and the ayin is the merging. So Eve chose to differentiate, to kind of self, to individuate. Differentiate is individuate. It's kind of the synonymous thing here. And to individuate for Hashem's sake, because Hashem created creation and wanted, presumably wanted them to unpack the potentials of their soul.
This was Eve's initiative, and she has been a founding force throughout history. Yet, in fact, she probably saved the day.
Like, it seems like it was what Hashem was wanting. He wanted someone to see through all the layers and to see his true will at core. And that's what she did. And she's been hounded for it.
Yay,
for
that.
Yeah.
Hopefully, eventually, when the truth is finally told, she'll be lauded as a hero and praised for her foresight, courage, holy chutzpah, and the service
methods.
It is interesting.
So this is very interesting.
It is interesting to note that Chabad's victory in correctly identifying an Avera Lishma and courageously acting upon it stands in contrast to Rav Zacharia ben Avuk
Akulas. He's the one in the Bar Kamsa story where the rabbis all ruled to Avera Lishma, all ruled to sacrifice the blemished offering from the, like, what do you call them? Roman governor. And because they understood that the Roman governor would kind of flip out if he saw that his korban, the korban that he sent, was not respected and not offered. And so they, pikuach nefesh, they ruled that this was an occasion for an avera lishma. And Rab Zacharia Kulas overrode them and insisted that they actually not, like, go by the letter of the law and not offer the korban. And as a result, and the Talmud, blames him, consequently, for all the suffering of creation after that point, because he is blamed for having destroyed the chain of cause and effect that was set in motion by that by not offering that blemished korban of the governor, the Roman governor, basically caused the temple to be destroyed and the temple destroyed is what makes the people Israel vulnerable to the nations and to the world. And so ultimately the repercussions of his decision to hold by the Chumrah is basically, it couldn't be worse than that.
Instructive.
Yeah. And so it's really like Chava's, it really, like, it's in contrast to Chava's courage to act on an Avera, to understand that this is an occasion for an Avera Lishma, and to act on it, and, really.
Whose timid veto of what truly was an Avera Lishma is shamed by the Talmud for causing the temple's destruction and our multi-millennial exile, the primary cause of our woes to this day. Chava is truly our prototype of rectified selfhood, of blazing the trail from Ayin to Ani. Paradoxically, Eve's badge of courage is her Avera Lishma. Yeah, so the cow will cry.
Are we continuing the same place?
Yeah, so now this is the next and last section before the practical section of the book. It's really where it kind of...
And so obviously Eve was the one who had to do it rather than Adam.
Uh-huh.
Okay, what was it about her, like the moon stage, what that she had more iron? Was it, it was more possible for her to make that choice? It wasn't, Adam couldn't do it?
Right, because it seems like it takes an aniness, like that was her... The individual, she understood that Hashem had created creation and he didn't want it to absorb back into him without having unpacked itself in a certain way. So she, chose life by choosing the tree of death, actually.
But she's made from a place of iron. She had talent, really, having a divinity.
But her path is from iron to ani. And so the ani is the individuation, like kind of, and so she was the one who could see that and to choose it, whereas Adam's path is the Rabbi Akiva path, which is towards, from Ani going to Ayin, and so his tendency was to just accept the status quo and work with it. That was his stretch was to be...
I'm hearing you. I think maybe you've addressed that. I think you're asking a different question. Was it her I-ness that allowed her to perceive Hashem's secret will?
I think it was her Ani-ness.
Ani-ness.
Yeah. I think so. But yes.
Yeah. I mean, on the surface, it would seem the opposite.
Uh-huh.
Of course, Adam has an Ani that needs to be diminished.
Uh-huh.
His Ani would stand up and...
But it's a chutzpah for an Avera Lishma is a chutzpah.
The understanding what the issue was and then knowing how to act on it, there may be two different...
Right here,
now I draw on this in order to respond. I need to respond.
But the Ani to do an Avera Lishma, I don't know. I mean, I do think that you do have to have a very refined ego in order to do it, but it seems like if your striving is towards Ani, you wouldn't, it wouldn't be natural for you to do an Avera Lishma from that point. I mean, one of the things that Rav Dessler also says is that, which I think I'm not sure who he says it in the name of, but that in terms of the Ahava and Yira, that Ahava, there has to be a certain self in Ahava, because it's like self to self, like Chava in her selfhood saw into Hashem's like selfhood somehow. Whereas Yira, yourself goes out the window, like you lose yourself, and so it seems like the Ani, it's the Ani-ness that was able to see into Hashem's core and choose an Avera Lishma.
That goes nicely with the fact that the Midrash says, what was Adam doing while Chava was so busy doing this Avera? And they say he was asleep. His selfness was not in the picture.
Uh-huh.
And Chava is portrayed as the one who was created already with the ability to nurture relationships.
Mm-hmm.
She can do this.
Mm-hmm.
She can do this and see what Hashem's real will. She can, that's why she can even have a meeting with Nachash.
Mm-hmm.
That all of this Adam is right. He's completely asleep.
Uh-huh.
While all this is going on, makes sense.
We have a reminder of all this every day, so funny kids will know.
Chava is already created with that. She's already Mahul. Right? She doesn't need circumstance. Right? Whatever it's been. She is interacting. That is her nature.
However, can service a need integration?
Yes.
So to say like this, with me, this each person has this starting and they want to individuate, to suffer himself on a certain level.
on a certain or not on a certain level from others.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Right, and Dalai Lama, yourself.
So if I say it in this way, so it's me, she passed that boulot. She expands the boundaries.
Therefore, when we were talking,
on one side she was able, as you were saying here, that she was very able to communicate that. But it has that rule, and the individuation should be on a certain size. We cannot expand out of them, that will bring our integration of Mustafa. Like there is the love of myself, and then to show myself to others, but then, in a sense, to give space to other people.
But are you saying that Chava expanded too much?
That's what came to my mind, because they, from fact, it was too much. I'm not sure this is what I'm saying. That's what, why you were talking this, because all these things that,
I don't know about that. I don't.
So what falls? If the feminism crashes,
Well, they both did, because he did.
You talk about the separate, the female falls in this epic is the rising of the feminine. So how does that fit into this?
Right. Well, but she, Right, so there is a certain, in this Avera, there is a Nisiva that happens. And so, and the Nisiva is the, that's actually what we're going to talk about. The next thing is about the three stages of relational development and how Jane comes into it.
Actually, Tikkun HaOlam is through Tikkun Chava,
which
is right. So there was something that needs to be fixed.
But that's the thing, is she's been hounded by it for, but I think she's going to be proven to be a hero, a heroine, and that in the end.
But in a way, inside out.
Right. The shame and challenge cultivating Ani, the feminine path of enlightenment. So this is a almost like an appendix to the section that we just read about how we decision to how are we doing on time following?
There are two ways that shame contributes something positive to growth and transformation. Shame as a precursor to humility associates primarily with the masculine path of Ani to Ayin, as Torah and Torah.
Meaning that in some sense the Ayin like state of refined almost transparent ego is the shame, like kind of shaved down, you know, like a tanning of animal hide. It's tanned so that it becomes pliable, and then it becomes even transparent, where you can kind of see light through it. And that's kind of the masculine path of kind of tanning the ego's hide, and that stuff that was originally like narcissistic in its refinement becomes like a transparent ego that is kind of a very rectified state. But it's the same stuff that you started with. It just has been refined.
Or shame as a negative incentive associates with the feminine path of Ayin to Ani.
Right. So which is where it's not, you don't want shame, and so you do other things to try to kind of prop up your worth, and that's like the cultivate, and so you become a strong Ani, but not in a bad way.
Anticipating judgment, my soul grows nauseous.
Yeah, I know. I think that's in the wrong place. It just
appears
again.
It's not the right thing.
Yeah. I noticed it last night that it's
very deep.
On the top of page 220.
It should go with the era of Adam. Yeah?
Where is it? That we did already? Or what?
Yes, that we did already.
Oh, you mean with the, yeah, Rabbi Akiva. Yeah, I have to look at where that was.
The second way that shame contributes positively to our growth path is as an extremely potent negative intensive. In trying to avoid or minimize its presence in our life, we must grow, mature, and enlighten. Shame is an aversive emotion that we want to be rid of as quickly as possible. To minimize the amount of shame in our lives, we try to avoid doing things that will bring shame, which basically means making wise decisions, being honest, cultivating integrity, minimizing secrets, keeping promises, and just generally being a mensch.
Right. I think what I would like to do in this last 10 minutes is the box on page 219. I think everyone is vaguely familiar with the teachings from Kabbalistic writings on the nature of masculine and feminine, but has everyone read it? Or?
No.
No. Okay, so I think we should do this real quick. It's just a summary because it's going to give paradigms that we're going to need for the rest of the section that we started. So this is a very brief summary of the Ari's Kabbalistic model of relationship from Eitz Chaim Hechanufa Shar Miut HaYorea. So who's reading? I think Susan.
Yeah. Based on a Talmudic tale about the sun and moon, Jewish mystical writings identify 7 stages that mark the evolving relationship of masculine and feminine through history. Since it is the moon, or cosmic feminine, that does the waxing and waning, these changes are also presented as stepping stones that mark the feminine life cycle. This model plays out on all scales, from the span of an individual woman's life to the history of creation. The entire period of existence, from beginning to end, is but a single circuit of the cosmic moon. These 7 stages divide into 3 primary phases. Phase 1, back-to-back equality. Phase 2, surgical uncoupling and collapse. Phase 3, front-to-front equality that is even more consummate than was possible before.
So that's, there are 7 stages, but there are these 3 categories, and the relationship evolves back-to-back, then there's the surgical uncoupling, and then there's the turning and the meeting of front to front and the developmental process that happens.
So the surgical uncoupling, you mean by back to face, face to back?
That's
they start off back to back.
Back to back, okay.
Yeah, and then there's the surgical uncoupling and they turn face to face.
But before it's not, okay.
It's a different thing. I think you're up, Seba.
Okay. In a decade relationship, the decoupled primary bond of attraction drives from projection and consciousness as an external
allures. Attractions.
Sorry?
It means attractions.
Attraction. In contrast, a front-to-front relationship is one where the couple shares common goals and maturity of desire. The Hebrew term of the face, panim, stems from the same word as the word of inwardness, nimiyut. The front-facing relationship is one where the couple inside meet and the soul unit.
Right. So you got that, like a back-to-back relationship is like kind of externality to externality and and each one of the couple is like, you know, kind of wanting to pull the other one along with it to their priorities, and it's, okay. The superiority of phase three, which is the front-to-front, derives from its preeminence on both the quantitative and qualitative scales of compatibility. In phase three, the masculine and feminine meet as spiritual equals, face-to-face, will-to-will. I mean, it evolves into that. It doesn't start there. The immanent and the transcendent faces of divinity, the Shekhinah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, unite from the crown of in a front-to-front relationship, unite from the crown of their heads to the soles of their feet. The Ari describes this messianic culmination as a meeting of equals, of masculine and feminine, finally standing, in the Ari's words, panim b'panim, shavei l'gamrei, face to face, and completely equal, and happily sharing a single crown.
Okay.
Two kings we use one. Right, okay. It's kind of, I guess, got twisted, but okay. Yeah. Right.
Yet waves between phase one and phase three is the most dramatic interval of the feminine's journey, the surgical uncoupling that releases the pair to turn from a back-to-back fusion into a face-to-face union.
This kind of Nisi Ra is described explicitly with Adam and Chava in Bereshit. It describes how Hashem puts Adam to sleep, the Nisi Ra, and Chava emerges as a personality unto herself instead of the subconscious layers of the unified androgynous Adam.
The Midrash has the Zohar as that he also puts her at his back.
A what?
A back. He closes off her back.
Well, his backside,
yes.
The Gevura, their backside is bound because things are close when they're similar.
Right.
So he has Gevura, she has Gevura, dark knots of unnaturalized potential, and so because of the drip that he's getting in his sleep from Ima, the Chasadim drip that he's getting, the Chasadim build, and they push the Gevurot from his backside off to her backside. And so now the Nisira happens because they don't share Gevurot back there, and so there is she takes on a double dose of Gevurot, which is that she's the Hishtalmut principle, the principle of perfecting as opposed to perfection. And they kind of go off on their own. She with the double dose of Gevurot, and he with this additional chasadim that he received from Ima in his sleep state.
For the feminine, this boon comes as a great sacrifice. This quantum leap forward on the quality scale entails a major backslide on the vertical scale that measures women's access to higher life.
I have all kinds of diagrams for this, but in the Nisi Ra, as soon as they are separated, she diminishes. And and begins a whole journey of having to reattain her stature. And the idea is that when she diminishes, like certain lights that she contained in her back-to-back state, now in her diminished state, what happens to those lights? They can't fit into her smaller stature anymore. And so they are absorbed by her benzug. And so they now turn front to front, and his job is to work. He is allowed to work with those lights that he got from her, you know, kind of temporarily, like it's kind of an investiture. He didn't develop. He could work, like, he can gain whatever is to be gained from those lights that he kind of received from her in her diminishment. But his job and his mission is to be committed to transferring those lights back to her as she becomes able to hold, as she unpacks herself and becomes able to hold more and more of that, those consciousness lights. And until eventually they, and that's where we are so much in history. Like it's a very, like the feminine has grown in stature and she's ready to receive those lights, take those lights back. But he's been using them and identifying with them. And so it's not so simple for him to be so willing to build up his, you know, his feminine basuit. And so there's a little bit of territoriality happening these days in this transition. And also for him, who is he going to be when he gives all those lights back? It's an unknown, and that's very scary. And so he's kind of attached. It's scary for him to give back, you know, all these consciousness lights that he's been using and identifying with and benefiting from. And who's he going to be when he does that? So it also creates a territoriality that is, you know, kind of one of the difficulties of current events. I mean, it really is.
And even the way that went up, wouldn't he startle?
Right, right, exactly. But he had, like, yeah.
There are two different metaphors that are used in this story. In one place it says, "En shnei melachim neshamshim kekeder achad," they'll both share one crown.
Mm-hmm.
And in the other it says, "En shnei melachim neshamshim desharvit achad," with one scepter.
Uh-huh.
Either way, you would think that Hashem doesn't have a problem giving each one their own crown.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
They could easily have had two scepters or two crowns.
Uh-huh.
But the fact is that we want to reach a point where they both share
right. That
one crownness or that one scepter.
Right. And that's a happy ending.
Okay, the changing of the guard. In the morning, he comes and he hands her either the crown or the scepter or both, right? What does it mean? Does it mean that without those, he is less? He is nothing?
Well, that what is will. Crown is will. Yes. So he really, I mean, I think that the whole AI, all that, is like kind of what the masculine is generating when it kind of takes its job seriously as is chidush, like, you know, you do have to, you're going to transfer all that you've kind of worked on and built so far that you need to pass on. But that will leave space for you to develop this chidush in store for you that you have to just close your eyes and go for it.
There's a lot of amona.
Yeah. And so I do think that there's so much chidush coming in right now to our, that's really the masculine doing their thing. Yeah.
But I think it's a lot of information chidush rather than integration. That's the trick is to make sure it's also integration.
Right.
Yeah. So it's cat.
Okay.
So where are we picking up next week? So
at the bottom of, we still have a little bit of that blue thing.
On the page of the blue thing. So everybody can have a Shabbat.